Hello, welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum, Thursday afternoon, Comic-Con's in town. I don't know what the list of good things going on is just too long to get to all of them.
They probably have a Good Place panel down at Comic-Con.
Oh, right.
Yeah, because they haven't had in previous years.
The Good Place is a
sitcom.
A sitcom. Very well done, hilarious, well-written sitcom. The only sitcom...
Not always family-friendly, but surprisingly mostly family-friendly.
It's the only sitcom I have ever seen that tackled the trolley problem.
Yeah, how about that?
Yeah, so maybe you want to explain the trolley problem. It's a fascinating philosophical question.
Okay, so our first question of the hour, what is the trolley problem?
Okay, there we go.
The trolley problem is a philosophical experiment proposed by the philosopher Philippa Foote, and it's designed to help tease out our moral intuitions about certain situations. It proposes a series of similar scenarios. Kind of the base scenario is you're on a train and it is out, or a trolley, and it is out of control, hurtling down the tracks, and you see that there are five people in front of you who will be run over and die if nothing changes. Mm-hmm. But you have a lever that you can throw that will divert the trolley onto another track. And on that track, there is only one person who will die if you pull the lever. So the question is, do you take no action and allow the five people to die, but so to speak, your hands are clean? Or do you pull the lever knowing it will lead to the death of one person? Now, when presented with that scenario, most people will say the thing to do is pull the lever. Mm-hmm. And it's just unfortunate that someone else is going to die, but you should save as many lives as you can. But then other scenarios start getting proposed. Like, suppose you're not actually on the trolley. Suppose you're on a bridge over the tracks. And so you're not on the trolley. You cannot pull a lever to make it go down that other track. But you are standing next to a really obese person who you could push onto the tracks,
right,
causing the trolley to veer onto the sidetrack so that fewer lives are lost.
But not
that. And there may even be nobody on the second track. It's just you've got to push this one guy over to save the five.
Right.
And would it be moral to do that? Because it looks from one perspective the same. You're losing one life to save five.
Right. Yeah.
And at this point, most people's ethical intuitions flip and say, no, you cannot. You could pull a lever that diverts the trolley, but you cannot actively push a person into the trolley's path to save others.
Well, now you tell me. I mean, I wish I would have known that before.
Well, you do now.
Yeah. So you said the Good Place will probably have a panel down there at Comic-Con.
Yeah, because they have in previous years, too.
Yeah.
And so, it's always fun after Comic-Con to check out YouTube for the panel discussions.
Oh, yeah. Right. At open forum here, if you got questions about Comic-Con, that's fine. We'll do our best to get you an answer. But mostly the questions will have to do with the Catholic faith, Catholic teaching, Catholic people. Or as Jimmy was saying earlier, a general question about the Christian faith is perfectly welcome. Whether you're Christian or not, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're religious
faith in
or
general.
Not. Yeah, right. Like... general questions about God are always—I find those always fascinating. So we're happy to take your call. In other words, whether you're Catholic or not, and you have a wide array of things that you can call about. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. Let's go to Evie in Huntington Beach, California, watching on YouTube Live. Hi, Evie in Huntington Beach. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hi.
Hi. Your question for Jimmy.
Yes. My question is it true that, or how accurate is it that the Catholic Church got invented priestly celibacy to get rich?
Yeah. Well, that didn't work.
Because when I'm a priest, they would be celibate, so then all their wealth would go to the church. But then if they were going to form a family, then the wealth would go to the family. And so that's the reason why the Catholic Church invented celibacy.
No, that's not why. The reason the Catholic Church invented celibacy is for two reasons. Number one, Jesus was celibate. Okay. He chose to consecrate himself to God in a special way, both because being celibate is the final state of redeemed humans. I mean, as Jesus says, we're going to be like the angels in heaven. We're not going to be marrying and giving in marriage. So in heaven, we're all going to be celibate. That is our final state. And Jesus exemplified that even in this life. Also, he had a mission. And having a wife and kids would have kind of not been a great idea if you're planning on going to the cross and dying and then ascending to heaven. And so also for practical reasons, Jesus refrained from marriage. And he was not unique in that regard. There were other people in Judaism at the time who did the same thing, including St. Paul and St. Barnabas. And St. Paul recommends this to Timothy, telling them, like to be a good soldier of Christ and like any soldier, not get entangled in civilian affairs, but seek to please the one who enlisted him. And so so we had celibacy as a practice for religious leaders, not everyone, but for religious leaders in the Christian faith right there in the first century. And it's always been continued down to this day with varying regulations. Sometimes it's been more common, sometimes it's been less common. We've always had both celibate priests and married priests in the church. So this was not something the church invented to get rich.
Okay. And of the time where the church might have been rich, how did the church get rich?
Well,
during those times, because I know now it's not.
Principally, it was through donations. Sometimes churches, and rich is a relative thing, but there have been times when local churches were well off economically, given the undeveloped state of the economy. And you would sometimes have churches running enterprises that would themselves make money. Like, for example, a lot of monasteries support themselves through agriculture, and they not only raise enough food for their own members, but they may sell some of the produce to others. Or they would provide other services, like being publishers of books. You know, monks knew how to write, and so they would make books for people. And sometimes they would make these beautiful illuminated manuscripts that then rich people outside the church would want and would pay a lot of money for. So sometimes it was through providing goods and services to people, they would make money. But most of the time is through donations. Sometimes they would get donations, you know, when someone joined a monastery, let's say, and there were people who would, you know, have inherited money and then they would donate it all when they joined a monastery. But that's not the principal way monasteries got donations. They principally, and churches, they principally got them, and especially churches, because you didn't join a church the way you join a monastery.
Mm-hmm.
It was principally through voluntary donations and offered by the faithful. Some of whom were rich and would give big donations, some of whom were poor and would give small donations, but it's primarily through donations, although there was some admixture of goods and services provided.
And we will leave that there. Evie, thank you very much for the call. I hope it was helpful to you. Let us go now to Chris in Ohio. Hey, you're big in Ohio today, Jimmy Akin. Chris in Ohio, your question, please.
My question is, I heard that Pope Gregory the Great said it was a sin, or it could be a sin, to eat food just to satisfy your palate. And then I heard from another website that said it could be a sin to eat between meals. And I was just wondering about that. And what would it look like just to eat to satisfy one's palate?
Okay. Well, so the first one is, and I can't vouch for the claim that you heard that a particular pope said this. What I can tell you is what contemporary moral theology would say about this. With regard to the first question, it is not a sin to eat in order to have a good experience. The reason we have a good experience when we eat and when we eat certain types of food is to get us to eat them. Because our bodies need nourishments. We need both macronutrients like fat, protein and carbohydrates, but we also need micronutrients like vitamins and minerals. And so we have appetites to get us to eat, and it's pleasurable when we do eat. And that's part of the biology that God built into us to get us to eat so that our bodies would have the fuel they need, both on the macronutrient level and the micronutrient level, to keep going and sustain life. So there's nothing wrong with saying, "Ooh, that pizza sounds really good. I want a slice of pizza." There's nothing wrong with that. Now, if you eat to an extent that it causes problems, then that does potentially become sinful. Like if you want to eat lavishly, knowing that someone else who you could feed, who's right outside your door, is going to starve, like Lazarus and the rich man in the parable, then that kind of eating, you know, could be sinful, because you could easily help Lazarus. He's right outside your door, but no, he's starving and you're stuffing yourself. Also, if you know that if I eat this if I follow this eating pattern and it's going to cause me severe health problems later on, well, then you're eating in a way you shouldn't. And so there is some element of sin there. It's usually venial. It'd have to be special circumstances to make a single act of eating mortal, though I can imagine circumstances where that would be the case. But I would say if you are eating simply to please your palate without reference to these other issues, like your own health or the needs of other people, and you're just gorging yourself on fineries or whatever, then that would constitute a sinful form of eating, because you're so focused on your own pleasure to the exclusion of other important moral values. On the other hand, it's not wrong to take pleasure in eating. That's why we have pleasure when we eat. So I would say those about that. In terms of eating between meals, the Catholic Church is not going to say it's sinful to eat between meals. There's no set eating pattern that is mandated by God. It varies widely over culture. I will say, based on personal experience, that eating between meals is not necessarily a prudent thing to do much of the time, because what happens when you ingest new calories is it causes your blood sugar to go up, which causes your body to release insulin, which causes a variety of health problems when your insulin gets too high. And you do that long enough, you eat just snack constantly between meals, things are going to happen, like you're likely to get overweight and get diabetes and things like that. So eating all the time is not a great idea, but it's not sinful occasionally to have a snack.
Chris, thank you very, very much for the call. We are late for a break, so we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Many Protestants believe Christians can be absolutely sure they're going to heaven, because John tells us in 1 John 5:13, "I write this that you may know you have eternal life." But is this true? The answer is no, and here are some reasons why. First, John writes in the next verse, and this is the confidence which we have in him. For John, the knowledge we have of our salvation is not a certainty without doubt, but a confident assurance. And that's the Catholic belief. Second, we know this is what John means, because in verse 15, he draws a parallel between our knowledge of salvation and our knowledge that God grants our requests. Do we have absolute certitude that God will grant our requests? No, but we are confident he will answer. So, Catholics need not worry. John is not teaching Protestant doctrine here. I'm Carlo Broussard with the Ready Reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Prayer is an opportunity to spend quality time with God. So pray from the heart. Let God know you trust Him, believe in Him, and most of all, that you love Him. My favorite prayer that I say many times a day is, "Jesus, I trust in you." It is simple, but as we know from St. Faustina, it reaches his heart.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live Open Forum. Jimmy Akin with us for the entire hour, and there are lots of calls, so I am just going to move and move and move. Joe in Ohio, are you there with us now, Joe?
Yeah.
Okay, Joe, your question for Jimmy.
So my question is it immoral sin to say, like, oh my God, I take God's name in vain? And my answer to another question, would it be a sin to, like...
I'm sorry, Joe, can you speak directly into the phone and not have us on speakerphone? I'm having trouble understanding you.
Yeah.
So
my question is it immoral sin to say, like, oh my God, or, like, would it be, like, a sin to, like, not stop someone from saying, oh my God, not telling them? You know, that is a sin.
Okay. So this falls under one of the Ten Commandments, you know, you shall not take the Lord's name in vain. And what that originally meant is sometimes debated by biblical scholars. It is often thought to be like a prohibition on falsely swearing in court, where you would invoke the Lord's name and like the Yahweh knows what I'm saying is true.
Yeah.
And you're falsely swearing that. So like perjuring yourself. On the other hand, it's in Hebrew, it's written in such a way that it can be broader than that. And theologically, down through the ages, it's been recognized as at least having a broader application. You know, like the other Ten Commandments state specific cases that then have broader applications. And that's true in this case. God's name is holy, or, you know, the sound itself is just sound. It's syllables. It's not intrinsically holy. But because it represents God, who is supremely holy, we need to treat it with reverence. And so it's holy in that sense. We need to treat these sounds in our language that way. And that means not using them in ways that would be inappropriate. In order to have an inappropriate usage, it's can be tricky to discern that. There are situations where it's clearly inappropriate to use God's name a certain way, like in blasphemy. You know, if you were to curse God, okay, that's clearly violating, that's clearly not using his name in a holy way. On the other hand, there are positive uses of his name, like in God bless you when you say it and you mean it. Then there are kind of middle cases, which could be neutral or are otherwise hard to decide, is this really good or is this really bad? In those cases, it would seem that the matter is sufficiently ambiguous that a person is not going to have the kind of knowledge needed in order to make it a mortal sin. And similarly, humans have a certain inbuilt instincts that have linguistic expression. The impulse to curse. Now, oh my God is not a curse. It's an expression of surprise or amazement. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear something that's amazing. Someone might say, oh my God.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you know, you are enraged at something, if your rage circuit is triggered, then you may have an inclination to say, to invoke God's name and say, you know, God damn this, or some variation on that,
right,
and mean it.
Yeah.
And originally people did. That's actually, and it's fascinating, people have a tendency to substitute words for even worse words, you know, as euphemisms.
Yeah.
And you can actually tell, linguists have done a lot of research on the history of cussing. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the F word in expressions like F you is actually a euphemism for what was in the past considered a much more horrible thing you could say to someone.
Really?
Damn you.
Oh,
that was considered even worse than F you.
Well, it is. Yeah.
And if you mean
damn
it literally,
is the worst
it is.
Thing that you can do.
Yeah. So if you say things, as with any other sin, if you got grave matter, you're seriously wishing damnation on someone, and And you don't care. You don't want them to repent. You just want them damned. Mm-hmm. And you know the moral character of your act is gravely wrong, and you do it deliberately anyway. Well, then it would be a mortal sin. And but the vast majority of the time, people are doing this by instinct because, as I said, these circuits, like the rage circuit, is built into our brain, and they take on whatever cultural form is we hear around us.
Right.
And so most of the time, people are doing it. Frequently, they're doing it without even thinking. So and also without considering the moral character of the act. And so it's not, it doesn't either have the requisite level of knowledge or the requisite level of deliberation to make it a mortal sin. And so at most of the time, it's going to be venial.
Yeah.
And that then sheds light on the second question. Do you have an obligation to stop people from doing it? Well, if I knew that someone was about to say, damn you, to someone else and mean it literally, they don't want repentance, they want you in hell, and they know the moral character of this, and they are going to do it anyway, well, they've already sinned in their heart, like Jesus said. But I might have some obligation or at least a desire to stop them and say, you need to think about this.
Yeah.
You stop, you know.
Like you might do for any sin. Like you
Exactly, for any sin.
If
I saw someone about to commit adultery.
Right. Like even if the person had already decided, you still want to stop them from Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. On the other hand, if the people around me aren't the cleanest talkers and they do thoughtlessly, unintentionally use words like this, then what they're doing is a venial sin. And it's then a judgment call of, will I lead them closer to God or farther, or will I push them farther away from God if I try to correct their language?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I'm a parent, I might insist for my kids, language, you know?
Yes.
We don't talk that way in this house.
Or if you're Captain America.
Or if I'm Captain America.
He will not tolerate foul language.
Exactly. And he shouldn't. But if I'm, you know, around office workers or people I know socially and they're saying little things like this in a venially sinful way, I might do something to indicate, you know, a little bit of displeasure there, but I'm not going to drop the hammer on that and read him the riot act, because that would have a tendency in most cases to actually make them view me, and to the extent they take the faith seriously, other Christians, as a bunch of snobbish prudes who look down on them. And that's going to push them farther away from God, not lead them to him.
Joe in Ohio, I'm glad we were able to get in contact with you eventually. Appreciate it. Thank you for the call. It is open forum. And as I said, there are many, many folks on the line. So I'm just going to keep moving. Howard in Boston, Massachusetts, listening on the EWTN app. You are next. Howard, your question for Jimmy.
Hi. I've been divorced a number of years, and I just received my annulment.
Congratulations.
I'm wondering how I would proceed in being in dating someone when I'm not certain that I wouldn't be impotent.
Okay.
That wouldn't be a valid marriage if I was, and being chaste, I have no way of finding out if I'm impotent.
Yeah.
So, like your thoughts on that, whether or not I should even pursue dating, and number two, how would I have a discussion about a woman about this without sounding like I wanted a prenup?
Okay. So here's what I would recommend. The first thing is, in order for impotence to invalidate a marriage, it has to, it's not just impotence. It's not just having difficulty having sex or only being able to do it periodically. In order for it to invalidate, it has to be antecedent, meaning it's already there at the time of the marriage. It has to be perpetual, meaning you never actually can do it. And it has to be incurable. And today, that last condition is almost never fulfilled, because not only do we have drugs like Viagra that can help, we also have medical devices, penile implants, that can also help. So almost nobody today has perpetual, antecedent, perpetual, and incurable impotence. And therefore, unless you've had given those facts, I would say proceed on the assumption that you are not antecedently, perpetually, and incurably impotent. And I would say, unless you have strong reasons to in your past of, wow, this was really hard and we didn't have the technology to fix it at the time, unless there's something like that in your past, I would say that I don't know that it even requires a conversation. You know, if you're of a certain age, it can be reasonable to say, you know, we might have some difficulties in this area, but I love you. And, or assuming you're at the point where it'd be reasonable to have that conversation, you right. should be in love. Say, I love you. And I'm determined to work through this in whatever way, if issues like this do come up.
Howard, thank you very, very much for that call. I appreciate it. It's the second day in a row we had a Viagra mentioned. We never talk about Viagra.
Really?
No,
I didn't
we had
know
it 2 days in a row. Yeah. There are lots of folks on the line. Stay on that line because we are not going to go away for very long. We will be right back to take your calls. One line, maybe two lines open right now, 888-318-7884. Right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live.
Looking for an on-fire Catholic speaker for your event? Catholic Answers speakers will inform and inspire your audience to grow in their Catholic faith. For more information on booking a Catholic Answers speaker, visit CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com today.
In his new audio presentation, The Very First Fathers, apologist Jimmy Akin takes you on a tour of the earliest Christian writings outside the New Testament, from the most famous figures and most notable works to those lesser known but no less important. This pivotal time in the development of the early church is revealed in fascinating detail. Jimmy shows how, even in the first century after the resurrection, it was necessary to defend and explain truths that are still under attack today, such as the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist and the perpetual virginity of Mary. The Very First Fathers is a compelling look at the dawn of the Christian age and edifying listening for anyone who wants to understand and defend the full truth of Catholicism. Order your copy of The Very First Fathers today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew that she wanted those things, that in them somehow she would find God. Over the years as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
I'm Gloria Purvis.
I'm Monsignor Charles Pope.
And I'm Deacon Harold. The Morning Glory team talks about a musical that revives Lourdes.
Tomorrow morning, 7 Eastern. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Jimmy is a senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and also the author of many things, including two recent 20 Answers books, 20 Answers Protestantism and 20 Answers New Testament. You can find both of those and pretty much maybe everything else you've published at shop.catholic.com. I don't know. Is
not
it all
everything.
There? Not everything.
Everything I published through Catholic Answers that's in print.
Is there.
But all not right. things that are not in print or that I haven't published through Catholic Answers.
Like, no, you don't have to tell me. You don't have to tell me. It might be top secret.
Civil Rights Breakthrough, for example.
You wrote that?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So if you go online, and specifically you go to Amazon and you type in Civil Rights Breakthrough, Jimmy Akin, you will find something I wrote.
Oh.
It's a short story.
Now I can't wait for the show to be over. Mary, in Maryland, you are up next. Your question for Jimmy, Mary.
Well, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I recently was with a bunch of older ladies.
Mm-hmm.
were all retired, mm-hmm. and the discussions, these are Catholic women, were raised Catholic, went to Catholic grade school, high school, and they believe that Jesus, and they say there's evidence that Jesus is married with children to Mary Magdalene, and that she was also very high above the apostles, that Jesus appointed her to that, and that she is in this position because she was the first to see him after the resurrection. Now, how does one respond to something like that?
It's a bunch of nonsense. Now, obviously, you don't want to necessarily tell them that as your as the first thing you say, but this is not believed by any New Testament scholars of reputation anywhere in the world, whether they are Catholic or Protestant or atheist.
Sounds like the plot of a novel, actually.
Well, I was going to say, this is an idea that got popularized a few years ago in a novel called The Da Vinci Code, and before that, in a kind of paranoid medieval conspiracy novel called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which is where The Da Vinci Code got it from.
Okay.
This is not something that is supported by early Christian documents. You will have some attempts to support it from, for example, the Gnostic Gospel of Mary. Mm-hmm. But the Gnostic Gospel of Mary actually doesn't say any of this. It doesn't say that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene or that they had children or things like that. So you have a lot of misuse of the Gnostic Gospel of Mary, and it's not a reliable gospel. It dates from, you know, over 100 years after the time of Jesus, and it is not regarded as having actual valuable historical traditions about the life of Jesus by scholars of any persuasion. You will have scholars say it tells us something about Gnosticism, mm-hmm. and what later Gnostics believed, but it does not tell us about the life of Jesus. If you look at the New Testament, it's very clear that Jesus was celibate, and there are several reasons supporting that. There are several indications of that. Not only is there no mention of a wife, but we would expect one, because who's going to take care of her after Jesus dies? I mean, he does have a mom, and he arranged for his mom to be taken care of after he died.
Not the wife.
Not the wife. Then, number two, if you look in the Synoptic Gospels, Jesus talks about the question of celibacy. He says some men are born eunuchs, some men are made eunuchs by other men, and some are eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom. And the apostles come to Jesus in this context and talk to him about, well, if certain things are true, it'd be better not to marry. And he says, this isn't for everyone, but those who can accept it should accept it. And so he recommends celibacy for the sake of the kingdom. And he obviously is the pinnacle of Christian spirituality. It would be totally bizarre and contrary to the spirit of the gospel writers for them to record Jesus holding up an ideal that they knew he himself did not meet. Mm-hmm. So if they show him holding up celibacy for the kingdom as an ideal, that means they regarded him as meeting that condition. So the gospel writers regarded Jesus as celibate. Also, in the New Testament, it wasn't just the gospel writers, it was also St. Paul. Because in the and others as well, but in Paul's letters and in the book of Revelation and so forth, you have the church depicted metaphorically as Jesus's wife. Well, that metaphor would never have arisen if Jesus had a literal human wife.
That would be creepy.
People would never have thought about the church as the bride of Christ if there was a Mrs. Jesus somewhere any more than there would be a mystical bride of Cy Kellett if there's a real Missy.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So there are multiple lines of evidence that indicate this is just fantasy land.
Does that put your mind a little more at ease, Mary?
Yes, yes. They also say there's a book, a Gospel of Mary Magdalene.
Yeah, that's another name for the Gnostic Gospel of Mary. But as I said, it is a later document. It is not from the first century, and it is not regarded by historical scholars as containing accurate historical traditions. It also does not say a bunch of the things that this narrative wants to say about Jesus, like he and Mary Magdalene had children. That's totally not in there.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you.
All right. Mary, thank you very much for the call. 888-318-7884. The number. We go now to Sebastian in Sweden, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Hello from Sweden, Sebastian. You have a question for Jimmy?
Yes, I would like to ask about the two different resurrections in Revelation chapter 20.
Okay. So the... they've been understood differently by different groups of interpreters. One group of interpreters who are frequently found among premillennialists, they're people who believe that there's going to be a future earthly reign of Christ on the earth before the end of the world. Premillennialists will look at this passage and say, okay, the first resurrection is an event that's still in our future at the beginning of the millennium. Where certain, when Jesus returns at the second coming, dead Christians and only dead Christians are going to be raised from the dead. The rest of the dead don't participate in the first resurrection. That's something that occurs after the millennium at the very end of the world. So that's the common premillennial understanding. Everybody but premillennialists, and this would include the position of the Catholic Church, at least in broad terms, looks at the passage and says the first resurrection, it could mean a number of things, but it's most plausibly understood as the resurrection, well, either the resurrection to spiritual life we receive as Christians in this life, that there's a kind of spiritual, you know, who talks about how we were dead in trespasses and sin, but now we're made alive with Jesus Christ and so forth, and we're baptized into his life, so we walk in new life, and it and we're regenerated and born again, and that's that new life we receive, that's the first resurrection, which is what gives us power over hell. If you have the first resurrection, you don't, unless you sin mortally, you aren't going to go to hell. On the other hand, it could be a resurrection to spiritual life that occurs for the blessed upon their death. So you die in this life and then you are raised to be with God, and that's the resurrection. That's the raising to spiritual life in heaven. That's what the word resurrect means, is to raise. Okay. And so you're being raised to spiritual life with God in heaven. And that's why you don't go to hell if you have a part in the first resurrection. So there are different understandings. The Catholic Church doesn't have a particular one as what the first resurrection is, but that is but it does not teach premillennialism. So it's not going to agree that the first resurrection is a physical event before an earthly millennium. On the other hand, everyone pretty much agrees the second resurrection, whatever else is true, second resurrection is a bodily event that really will occur at the end of the world.
Sebastian, is that helpful to you?
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah.
Thank you very, very much. It's always exciting to get a call from Sweden. We better take a break. We'll be right back with more. Jimmy Akin, Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
When you are predictable in your authority, you will actually have to use that authority less. Consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. The more you act when you need to act, the less you will have to act in the future with similar misbehavior.
The Doctor is In with Dr. Ray Guarendi. This afternoon, 1 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
love history around here. That's why we're having a Deep in History sale at shop.catholic.com. Dozens of great CDs, books, DVDs, all on sale. Go to the shop at shop.catholic.com and click on the Deep in History banner and check out all the deals. Special pricing ends Sunday. Jimmy Akin is our guest. These 2 hours, and but most importantly, for the next 20 minutes, if you missed the stuff before, here's Emma in Hayden, Idaho, listening to EWTN online. Emma, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Cy. Howdy.
Jimmy. Hi. That's nice. Hi, Cy. Howdy, Jimmy.
Music.
What's that?
No groovy music. Groovy music.
I know. Nick needs to trot out the groovy music.
It's hurting my heart.
Yeah. That's kind of hurting my heart now that you said it, Nick. What's up with the... he's got a new baby at home, so let's just give Nick a break. Yeah. He's got a brand new baby at home. So,
how can we help you, Emma?
Okay, so I'm a Protestant.
Mm-hmm.
I've been listening to Catholic radio for a few years now.
Must have been if you know about the groovy music.
Well, yeah, there you are.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in transubstantiation, but I am really struggling with Mary, and I've asked the Holy Spirit to intercede for me, and I still haven't got anything confirmed. But how can she be everywhere if she's answering prayers all over the world? I mean, you know, every second of the day she must be being prayed to. How can she attend the prayers? Does she have, like, Mother Teresa helping her or something like that?
Well, so there are a number of possibilities here. Now, first thing, Mary is not omnipresent. She is not everywhere the way God is. But God is omnipresent, and God is also omniscient. God knows everything. And so God knows all of our prayers. And the common opinion among theologians is that the way the saints know about our prayers in heaven is God tells them. So if you're praying and asking a particular saint for their intercession, God will nudge the saint and say, hey, this person would like your prayers, and then you can pray for them. So it's not that they know this on their own. That's at least the common understanding of the mechanism of how they learn about our prayers. It's God himself. In terms of the other question, which is sort of the bandwidth question, how could Mary pray for everybody who would like her intercession? Well, you mentioned one way. She could have a prayer team working under her. She could farm them out to other people. I don't know that that's what happens. That's not what the Catholic Church teaches, but it's a possibility. Also, you can always pray for any number of people all at once as long as it's in a general manner. I mean, I do that all the time. I'll pray for everyone in the world who would like my prayers, or everyone in the world who needs my prayers, whether they would like them or not. And sometimes I'll just pray for everybody. And so you can always pray for everybody in a general way, because God knows you would like blessings for everybody. You could also say, I'd like to pray, just like one of the petitions I mentioned, God, please help everybody who would like my prayers. And in the same, that's essentially what Mary could say in a general way, just, everyone who would like my prayers, please give them help. So that's another way that Mary could do it. But suppose a couple other things happen. Suppose Mary not only prays in a general way and doesn't just have a prayer team working for her in heaven. What if she personally attends to each and every prayer? How could that happen? Well, it's something we in this life can't do, but she's not in this life. She's in heaven. She's in a glorified condition. And that means a couple things. Number one, we're going to have a significant upgrade, according to most theologians, in our processing power in the afterlife. We're going to know more. We're going to be able to process way more information. We're going to know all kinds of mysteries we don't know in this life. We're going to have a serious upgrade to our intellects. Maybe Mary's upgrade is big enough she can handle all that data all at once. Also, here's the second reason. We don't know how time works in the afterlife. It may be just like it is here, but it may not be just like it is here. And as a result, we shouldn't look at people in heaven and assume that time works the same way for them. It works for us. It might just be a big Jeremy Baramee, and you could hang out in the dot of the eye and just sit there and have all the time you need to answer all the prayers for the people who would like you to pray for them. And so, so we don't know the answer here, but we have faith that one way or another, Mary is happy to pray for us. We don't know the exact mechanics of it, but we can see how it's possible for her to answer our prayers in, or I should say our prayer requests, in these different ways.
Okay, Emma?
As I said before, I love it when you're smart, Jimmy.
Thank
well,
you so
love
much.
Love him all the time, then.
Not always. I've done some dumb stuff.
Can I guess? No, I won't guess.
Not on the air.
888-318-7884, the number. I'm going right back to calls, but I just, in case you happen to be in Capitola, California tonight, or tomorrow you're going to be in Santa Clara, California, or in Los Angeles the night after, or San Diego the night after, Don Eden Goldstein, the author of Sunday Will Never Be the Same, a rock and roll journalist opens her ears to God, she'll be hitting those places on her tour as it brings itself to a conclusion. And you won't be sorry that you went to see Dawn. Just a wonderful speaker and person, and she knows all the old rock and rollers, and she's lived the life, so to speak, and she came into the Catholic Church, and it's wonderful to hear her share her story. So I encourage you to go to our Facebook page and find out where Dawn is going to be and get over there. It is open forum here on Catholic Answers Live. Up next is Bob in Michigan, listening on 990 AM. Bob, your question for Jimmy.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, Bob.
Okay. My question is, as I read the Bible and read the explanation of certain verses in the index of the Bible, It refers to verses coming from a source called M or Q.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain what that is or who that is?
Yeah, so these are hypothetical sources that have been proposed by biblical scholars. Q is taken from, it's short for the German word Quelle, which just means source. And it's a hypothetical source that was used by Matthew and Luke. The reason people propose Q is because there's a little more than 200, it's about 235 verses in Matthew and in Luke that are not in Mark that are extremely similar to each other. In fact, sometimes they use exactly the same wording. And so because these 230-something verses are so similar, some scholars have proposed that they must come from a common source, and that source is then called Q. The idea, according to the most common understanding, is that Mark originally wrote his gospel and someone we don't know wrote Q, and then Matthew and Luke came along and took some material from Mark and some material from Q, but they didn't both take exactly the same material. In addition, they had their own special sources. So Luke has stuff that's not in any of the other gospels. And Matthew has stuff that's not in any of the other gospels. It's unique to him. And that material, in German, it's known as the Sondergut material. It's also sometimes called like Matthew's special source or Luke's special source. And sometimes you'll see the letter M used for Matthew's special source. Also, you'll sometimes see the letter M used for the Gospel of Mark. And so it really depends on what the people who wrote the notes in your Bible, how they're using this these abbreviations. I would assume they've got an explanation of it in there somewhere. Important thing to recognize, these are just scholarly speculations. We don't really know that there were such sources. In fact, I personally am kind of doubtful there was a Q. I think it's more likely that Mark wrote first, Luke added to Mark, and then Matthew came along and liked 235 of the verses in Luke and used them in his own gospel.
Oh,
so
yeah.
He got it straight from Luke. You don't need to postulate an extra Q source.
Now, Bob, does that help you?
Yeah. Yeah, I tried to find an explanation somewhere in my Bible, but I haven't been able to find it, so I'm not sure where it's located. So I appreciate this explanation.
No problem. And good for you for digging into that Bible. Who's up next? Up next is Peter in Ohio. Peter, your question for Jimmy.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Got a follow-up question, Jimmy, in regards to your last hour where you were talking about limbo. Uh-huh. And what happens with kids who have not been baptized. I have personally gone through this with a couple of my grandkids where they passed away in utero. Mm-hmm. So one of them was 4 months along, one was 5 months along. I know because I have three grandkids that my son and his wife would have baptized the kids. Mm-hmm. And so there's that baptism of desire. Mm-hmm. What's the theology or what has been discussed in regards to that baptism of desire that these kids would have been baptized had they been born?
Yeah. So this is a kind of a proxy baptism of desire. And it is something that some have speculated on as a possible way that God could provide salvation for these infants, so that if the parents would have baptized the children, that kind counts as a proxy baptism of desire and can bring the child salvation that way. Also, people have speculated about the church's desire to baptize them, in which case it might not just be particular children, it might be all children, because the church wants the salvation of everybody. These are matters, though, of speculation, and so we don't know the answer, but they are two of the possibilities. It is possible that God may count the desire of the baptism, the desire of the parents for the child's salvation as a baptism of desire.
Okay.
Okay, sounds wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter. 888-31. Oh, I don't know why I'm getting out the number. We're about to conclude here. Let's go to Ginger. You are up next, Ginger. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. How do you like to present the case for Catholicism to Protestants? And what do you do when you do present the case? Like maybe you even mentioned like the Bible canon, how we got the Bible.
Yeah.
But they will still say all you need is Jesus and the Bible.
Well, it's a big question, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to give a general answer because of our time limitation. But I will point out that, you know, there are problems with sola scriptura. I'll also point out the case for the papacy. And I did a number of years ago a presentation actually at a Protestant seminary on this, and I wrote up the results in a document called Why Be Catholic? An Exercise for Evangelicals. And it's on my website, jimmyakin.com. So if you type in why be Catholic, you just use the Google machine, as Cy says, and type in Jimmy Akin, why be Catholic? And especially if you add an exercise for evangelicals, that paper will come up and you can read it in all its detail. Also, I have a new book coming out called The Bible is a Catholic Book. And I go into some of this there. Also, because your Protestant friends are going to have lots of specific questions and objections, I'd recommend my book, A Daily Defense, which gives more than 300 answers to different challenges to the Catholic faith.
Okay, Ginger?
Okay. Thank you.
You are very welcome. So when's the book coming out? I forgot.
September 15th is the official release date.
September 15th, The Bible is the Catholic Book. Mm-hmm. And in there, you're going to do history of how the Bible came to be?
Yep. And it interacts with Protestant questions about the canon and things like that.
Yeah, so if a Protestant, it's not the worst thing in the world to say you need the Bible and you need Jesus. Clearly, that's true, but... But her suggestion was, she wants to talk about, where did you get the Bible? And is that where
that's where part of it comes in, yes.
Yeah. So we got the Bible because...
Because of the Catholic Church. So it's a Catholic book.
Okay. What's the earliest part of it?
Of the Bible?
No, of the New Testament.
Of the New Testament, it is often thought to be either 1 Thessalonians or Galatians or the letter of James. They were all written no later than about AD 50, and some of them may have been written a little bit earlier than that, possibly as early as AD 48.
And your best, I know you've told me this before, but is it the year 30 or the year 33 that Jesus likely died?
Those are the two plausible candidates. The one that is the best supported is 33, which is also the traditional date, though that's not why it's the best supported. It's not just tradition. There's other factors pointing at it.
But what I'm getting at is that's basically 17 years between the death of Jesus and they start writing the New Testament.
Yeah.
Well, Jimmy, I really had a good time. Thank you very much for that.
Me too.
What's the topic tomorrow for Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
The Bilderberg Group. Are they sinister conspiracy, or do you believe their story that they're just a bunch of rich fat cats having a party in the woods?
That sounds like us here at Kathy Answers. Rich cat. I can't even say it.
No. No.
No, that, I guess it, probably no part of that describes us.
That's right.
Again, Jimmy, thank you very, very much. If you haven't checked it out, check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. New one out tomorrow. And we got Carlo and Trent coming in tomorrow. We're going to do the church in the news, various topics, as we have a panel discussion. You're welcome to call and join in. We'll see you then, God willing, on Kathy Answers Live.